I'm turning today to the first letter of John, chapter 2 and verse 15. 1 John, chapter 2, verse 15. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And our title is simply that, Love Not the World. Now the Apostle John is very old, and he's probably ministering at Ephesus in his later years. He writes this extremely fatherly letter, My little children, he calls us once and again. We've studied a number of things already, how he extols Christ, how he exhorts to holiness, how he deals with the theme of brotherly love, how he reviews the profound work within the Christian by the power of the Holy Spirit. And now he comes to the believer's relationship to this present world, this vain and passing world. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. And my first heading will be based on this 15th verse. We'll look hopefully at three verses this morning. And my heading first will be mutually exclusive affections. The point being that you cannot love the world and the Lord at the same time. Even an earnest believer, drawn aside to the love of the world, possibly, well, that will render impossible real love for the Lord. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now we know that the Apostle John often writes in rather extreme terms. And so it is here. You might think if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him, would suggest that he can't possibly be a Christian if you love the world. But with the Apostle John, that doesn't follow. He always states matters starkly, the extreme situation. It's his style, and God uses that style in this epistle. But he means clearly that even for a Christian, you may love the world overmuch, and your capacity to love Christ, to love God, will be seriously impaired while that's the case. So yes, it may be that you're not a Christian. It may be that we're in a backslidden state and condition. Love for the world and for the Lord, real love, is not possible at the same time. So we think of this for a few moments. And this is a vital principle. Love not the world. It is a choice. He's speaking to Christians. My little children, love not the world. It's under our control. If we are drawn into love of worldly things, overmuch love for the things of this vain world, well, we have the capacity, by the help of God, to withdraw from that. So the command can be given, as though it's in our power. Well, with the help of God, it is. Love not the world. It's our fault, if we do. It's a command of God. These things are ever of crucial importance. The world will define each thing in turn. We'll perhaps take the world before love. The world. The Apostle John does not mean the same thing by this world as he means back in verse 2 of chapter 2. And he, Christ, is the propitiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. Now in verse 2, his use of the term world clearly refers to the literal world, the geographical world. Christ died for his elect in every nation of the world, not literally for all people, but for all his people and his elect, Jews and Gentiles, everywhere. But here, down in this 15th verse, he begins to use the word quite differently, and the context makes that obvious. Love not the world. In 3 verses, he uses the word 6 times. But now he doesn't refer to the geographical world. He refers to this present social culture and order. The world under the orchestration and the government of Satan. The world in terms of a society, a people, a race in rebellion against God. The word translated world actually comes from the Greek for order, and it refers to an ordered universe, or world in our case, planet. But here it means the order or the system which is under satanic control as the result of the fall. Love not the world, human society away from God and its characteristics. The system of antagonism to God that Satan organizes in culture and society in every age, in every land. That's what is meant by the world. The system of unbelief and organized opposition to God, which is launched into every human heart by the enemy of souls. The system of human pride and rebellion against God. This world order. All the forces of fallen humanity. Anything that has no recognition of God or no love for God. Anything, any movement, any group, any attitude which promotes sin and anti-values, the opposite of the standards which God has revealed. It's all part of the system, the ordered system of Antichrist, which is against God. So we have to understand that. Is it not alarmist or overdramatic language? It's right through the New Testament. Love not the world. Christians soon discover that there are two systems. There is the will of God and the message of God, and there is the opposite, the message of antagonism to God and his values and his standards. And Christians are not to love that. Anything that promotes sin and antagonism to God, and we'll define it further. We ought to understand this. We've seen it in recent history. Unfortunately, it's not something that will be taught in modern history, but very modern history is the story of a particular acceleration in anti-values, anti-moral values, anti-God thought and teaching. And all those who are older in this congregation, you remember back to the 1960s and the formal launch almost of what became known as the permissive society and a new culture which descended upon us. People constantly say, young people in particular, I don't understand the difference between classical music and pop music. Well, I'm not going to attempt to embark on an explanation of that, except to say this, that in many forms of music, there has not in the past been a concerted campaign behind it different composers, different people have created many works, many compositions, and they haven't been thinking, with this I'm going to change society, with this I'm going to oppose God, with this I'm going to promote free love and anti-morals and so on. Until, perhaps some argue the jazz movement, but particularly the modern music phenomenon from the 1960s, which was all part of a concerted, shall I say, intelligent campaign to dethrone God and to teach the rising generation and all people anti-values, to teach the opposite of everything which has been revealed by God. So now you've got a movement, a campaign, something recognizable, something definable. Did you never see the difference? That's why we have nothing to do as Christians with modern pop, rock, everything. All the fields of modern entertainment, communication, which have a name, which have a purpose, that are promoted by artists and composers, that all have something in their minds, something they're trying to do. It's all part of this system, this order. Let's get the notion of God and obedience to Him and His standards out of the minds of the people. And people say to me, I can't tell why you make a fuss, why there's a difference, why you draw a distinction between this and that. Love not the world. And anything which is self-consciously, intentionally, deliberately a product of antagonism to God. That's the point. That's the purpose. That's the aim. That's the goal. Dear friend, we have to think about these things. There is a great war which is on, and it's been intensified between Satan, the enemy of souls, and the Lord Christ and his people and his message and his gospel. I remember, if you don't mind my being just a little anecdotal, in the late 50s, hearing Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones at the Westminster Chapel preaching on the Christian warfare from chapter 6 of Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Dear friends, these are tremendous passages that I can remember week after week, and he would read these famous verses. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore take unto you the whole armour of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Now I remember that among many young people, there was a group in that church, even in those days. I say this carefully because I don't want to characterize everyone by any means, but there was a group of young people that was rather worldly, well, very worldly, right up with all the nuances of fashion, right up with all the celebrities of the time. There were even celebrities then, young people. It's not a new phenomenon. Right up with all the fads and the music and whatever was going on in those days. And I can remember a group talking together. There was a young woman said to some of them, "You don't get any of this, do you?" she said. "You just don't understand what this is all about. Spiritual wickedness in high places, the spiritual warfare, the hosts of darkness arrayed against us." And one young man, who actually became, is retired now, a very distinguished physician here in London and a leading medical academic, but he had some wayward early years, even as an earnest Christian. And I can remember him saying, "Oh," he said, but that's reds under the bed." Well, that's an old expression that we used to use in the 50s, in those days of the Cold War between the West and the Soviet Union. People used to talk about Reds under the bed, which meant really meant you're exaggerating, you're being alarmist, you're seeing Soviet sympathizers everywhere and all this type of thing. That's where the expression came from. The Apostle Paul was just being dramatic. He was just being excessively alarmist. That's what he thought. You don't really think of a spiritual warfare and these things going on? Why, that little group of people, and they were very clever people and able people. I suppose today, if they were alive, well, they are alive, some of them, but if they were young today, they'd be those up to their neck in social media, liking all the current celebs, walking with one foot in the world. I know later some of them deeply regretted their younger days. They knew they were saved, but they had had one foot in the world. And they regretted the years they missed of service and commitment for Christ. No, the Apostle Paul wasn't being alarmist, dear friends. These things are serious. I remember being given as a youngster a precious book on Ephesians 6, chapter, famous work by the Puritan William Gurnall, The Christian Incomplete Armour. Later on it came out from different publishers in abridged editions. They're good too. But the full work. May I say, if you're thinking of buying a wedding present for a young couple that will really make a difference and help them and strengthen them throughout life's journey, don't worry about the luxuries on the John Lewis list. Buy the Christian Incomplete Armour. Apart from other things, it's even-handed, one volume each. Then you swap. That makes a tremendous difference. It's a spiritual warfare, friends, to be really earnest and serious for the Lord. The world and its system and its order. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. That system of pride and rebellion, substitutes for God, opposition to his laws. If you love the people that represent that and the culture that it produces, you cannot at the same time love the Lord. Says the Apostle Paul, be not conformed to this world. Love, what's that? Devotion. Admiration, approval, identifying with it, delighting in its allurements, attending all its movies, glued to its worst television programs, captivated by it, letting it take your time and your energy. That's loving the world and the things in the world. Says the Apostle John, the love of the Father is not in him. What a cumbersome phrase. The love of the Father is not in him. Some of the modern translations clip the wings of that phrase and say, the love of God is not exercised and things like that. No, following the Greek, the love of the Father is not in him. The love of the Father is seen as an exercise or an object. It's like a fragrance flowing out of you to God, devotion and love and obedience and service. And if the vessel of your soul, your mind, your heart and your affections and your will is occupied with this world, there's nothing in that vessel to flow out to God. Love for God cannot coexist with love for this world. My debt of love is being withheld. because my enthusiasm and devotion and affection is fixed on worldly things. I've switched sides. I'm honouring the things that are offensive to God. Verse 16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the Apostle John in some measure defines the things that are in the world. In three headings, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Not all food and drink is worldly, but anything that has a message and anything that is in excess is worldly. Not all housing, not all clothing is worldly, but anything that has a message or that vaunts you or is excessive is worldly. Does it have a message? What is your addiction to clothes or to fashion? Are the garments you wear, do they have a message? Do they promote bodily form and sensual attraction? Or do they conform to the very latest in this world to vaunt self, to promote the things of the flesh? Is there a message? Is it excessive? Not all labour and employment is of the world, but some is. Not all art, but most is these days. Not all recreation, but some is. People go dancing. I hope not Christians. I saw there's dancing in the Bible. Well, yes, there are chaste forms of dance, but not today. Whatever is on offer to us today is lascivious and sensual and showing off and exhibitionism and seeking attention and seeking sexual arousal. That's what it's all about. Wake up, friends. It's of the world. It's designed and planned to ensnare and to achieve that so that people can be sensually indulged. That's the whole idea. So you don't go and say, well, I read that in some parts of the Bible, the little children danced with tambourines and things like that. Well, they did. That was chaste. Then people say, what about my culture? Well, you know full well, in all cultures, tribal dances are invariably to do with spiritism, animism, and arousing of the flesh. So it's no good saying, you're taking away from me my culture. We're converted. We've left that culture. Whether it's British culture or African culture, some things may be good we can retain, but many things we're deeply suspicious of. They're of the world, in all cultures. And that's how Christians think. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, well, you can see what that means. Excess, pampering the flesh, or sensuality, or luxury. All that is of the flesh distinctively is worldly. The lust of the eyes, covetousness, the longing to have and to be seen to have, to be special, to be better than, to be distinctive, and all the rest of it. The pride of life, conceit and boasting and contempt for others, an undue self-confidence and self-reliance, the pride of life and status. You see it played out in public life. You see it, however, everywhere. All that is in the world, the things that appeal to the flesh, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes, and that includes the ears, all the senses, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. That's the teaching of the Apostle John. This world is like a minefield. There are snares everywhere. The Christian who doesn't see, it's like a sea full of sharks. It's like a city full of infection. Wash your hands often, they tell us. People, young people, had to be careful. Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, if you walked around the streets of London, and be careful anywhere near the city and the docks. Why? Because the press gangs roamed. If you are upright and reasonably healthy, you could be seized and you'd be serving as a rating on a man of war, or even as a merchant ship before you knew it. They couldn't get seamen. The press gangs, they were highly paid. And your family never saw you again until maybe they got a letter from you from some distant place. You'd been press ganged. And that's how Satan works. Looking round like a roaring lion, says the Apostle Peter, seeking whom he may devour. And here I am, maybe I'm a youngster. Oh, I can't depict a youngster, but maybe I'm a youngster. 17, 18, 20, 21, experimenting with all sorts of things. Knee-deep in social media, looking and listening to all sorts of things, blissfully unaware of the dangers. Oh, dear friends, don't be blissfully unaware. Have some depth. Be careful. It's not a preacher saying this. For all that is in the world, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. Does the thing you're into parade and promote anti-moral values? Is it sensual? Does it bring people into captivity? Does it express rebellion against God and unbelief in Him? Your music, your activity, your recreation, your reading, your movies, your films. So many of them do. People can be so foolish. I've seen even ministers write blogs reviewing films that they shouldn't be watching, full of everything which is godless. And they watch it. They filter out what they don't agree with, or they think they do. They kind of unwatch it, but you can't unwatch anything. It influences you. It has an effect on you. Less and less do you mind sinful things and lewd things. You accept them. You don't want to indulge, but you accept this is life. Sin doesn't seem like terrible sin anymore. Things don't seem so bad. What foolishness are we into, dear friends? I don't want to just sound negative or severe. Does it promote unbelief and false values? Well, friends, I come to verse 17, and this is a magnificent sentiment. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. Now, our King James Version is quite accurate, but we could be more pointed. The world passeth away. It would be a little bit better and a tiny bit more accurate if it was translated, and the world is passing away. That's the Greek. There's nothing wrong with the King James, but it could be a bit stronger. The world is passing away. The Greek is interesting. passeth away is passing away. Literally, the world is led by, or led near, or led away. Picture somebody with a donkey on a short tether, leading the donkey somewhere where perhaps it doesn't want to go. The world is being led away. Think of a line of prisoners in ancient times. Perhaps robbers. Who knows? They've been arrested. They used to tie them together, you know, and then attach a rope and lead them off. And you'd see them sometimes paraded through the town, led by a rope, led away, meekly, subservient now, arrested, in charge, being led off to court or to condemnation or to imprisonment, or if it was a lesser offence, to the stocks in the market square, heads bowed, led away. That's the idea. The world is passing away. It's led away. Isn't it marvellous? The way God orders things, we are seeing the world under judgment even now as we look. Where is the Assyrian Empire, so hostile to the people of God, and God allowed it to be so, to punish them for their sin? Where is it? It's gone. We're in the 21st century. It's gone. It's been led away long since and forgotten. And so has the empire of Greece, the Medo-Persian Empire. It's gone. And so is the Roman Empire. It's vanished. And so is the Mongolian Empire and the Spanish Empire and the Russian Empire. But if you go to the Far East, the Ming and the Qing empires, that was vast. They've gone. They've been led away one after the other. Don't you see it? Even in history, we can see that this world passeth away. Generation after generation is led away, and the people are no more. The British Empire. It always surprises me to read, even after all these years, that was the territorially the biggest empire ever. What? Us? We were the biggest ever? Yes, we were. When was that? Well, it was quite recent. The zenith of the British Empire, it wasn't in Victorian times, it was in the 1920s. And then it all began to fold and bit by bit be eroded and then taken away. And now it's extinct. It's gone. It's been led away like that donkey on a tether. It's finished. All its pomp and circumstance, it's vanished. All the empires, some worse than others, some awful, but they've gone. I could really bore you to tears, young people. I could tell you about people who were famous in the 40s and the 50s, and you'd sit with complete bemusement listening. You'd never heard of them. If you'd done modern history, you may have heard of some of them. I could tell you all about the prime ministers of old, and you'd be amused at this old fellow rambling. They've gone. They're no more. You've heard of Churchill, you've heard of one or two, but most of them you've never heard of. I mentioned something to a couple of highly intelligent youngsters only the other day, and they looked at me very puzzled. You have to watch your tongue when you're older. You can seem very strange. It's gone. The world of the past. This world passeth away. Tyndale put it, vanisheth away. That was a bit of a stretch in translation, but it's powerful. And we see it before our eyes, people falling, people being forgotten, even great inventions. I remember once, it just occurs to me as I speak, being in Stratford-on-Avon, and I went to see the place where Shakespeare grew up and lived. And I went into his bedroom, like other people, peering and looking, and there behind the rope was his bed. He was very fond of his bed, so he tells us, and some wonderful poetic lines about his bed. And I looked at this awful contraption, and I thought, how could anybody sleep in that? Once upon a time, it was the greatest thing imaginable, and the most sophisticated. It was an awful thing, and so hard, and stretched out by ropes and all kinds of things. What's this got to do with our message? It's generation after generation vanishing away. If the world goes on, and I doubt it will, I believe Christ is coming soon. But if the world were to go on another 50 years, people would look at amusement at these little devices which occupy our time, morning, noon and night, and consume the lives of young people and fill their heads with nonsense. They will be seen as primitive one day and simple and odd. How could people be hooked on all that? This world vanisheth away. Pride of man and earthly glory, sword and crown betray his trust. What with care and toil he buildeth, tower and temple fall to dust. But God's power, hour by hour, is my temple and my tower. So runs the German hymn. Dear friends, the world passeth away. Even before our eyes, it's going under judgment. Don't live for that. Don't love what God is taking away. But he that doeth the will of God, you love him, and you serve him, and you live for him, abideth forever. Let's close our thinking singing the hymn number 250. Hymn number 250. Alas.